Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Klingsborn. I represent the appellant, Ricardo Flores Magon Academy. Registration number is 38997. The sole question before you in this appeal is whether Article 14 of the lease agreement between the parties is ambiguous. Article 14 provides, notwithstanding anything to the contrary in this lease, tenant may elect to terminate this lease at the end of any current fiscal year of tenant by giving landlord notice of non-renewal no later than June 30th of each year of the lease term. Now, if the court finds any ambiguity in this language, it will be the first time that anyone has done so. The appellee, Eagle Heights, hasn't identified anything ambiguous in that language. In fact, they admitted below that that first sentence of Article 14 sets forth an unconditional right of termination. Tenant may elect to terminate this lease at the end of any current fiscal year. The first judge below, Judge Delgado, didn't either. Her order denying summary judgment never identified what the ambiguity was that was contained in the contractual language. And at trial, Judge Crabtree never reached the issue. He simply relied on Judge Delgado's earlier order and admitted the parole evidence. Our position is simply this. Because Article 14 unambiguously grants the Academy an unconditional right of termination, it was error to admit and to consider all the extrinsic evidence that Eagle Heights presented at trial and which, in its brief on appeal, it still relies.
Let me ask you, if I may, Mr. Klingsborn, let's take out all the extrinsic evidence for purposes here and look just at the language. If I'm understanding, let me first say, the issue of whether it's ambiguous is a question of law, is it not?
Purely a question of law.
All right. So looking just at the language, if I'm understanding your argument, I think you equate non-renewal and termination. The first word talks about elect to terminate, then it talks about a notice of non-renewal. I think that you would agree there aren't any renewal rights in this lease, and the term non-renewal is not defined anywhere. So I guess I'd ask the question, you know, in terms of why do you think renewal necessarily means the same, or non-renewal means the same thing as termination, and couldn't it be referring to renewal of the appropriation? Why is, you know, why do you pick one of the over the other?
To take the first part of your question, Judge Gabriel, I interpret that first sentence as providing for a right to terminate and then explaining what sort of notice would be required to exercise that right. And that notice provided for in the contract would be a notice of non-renewal. We are not renewing this contract.
But there's no right at the end of the year to renew or not. And there's not even any right to renew. I forget if this is a 10-year lease, but at the end of the term, there's no right to renew. And so that's why I'm puzzled. I mean, could you not, I'm playing devil's advocate with you, of course, and push back. Could you not read this to mean, when you look at the entirety of Article 14, could it not mean that the tenant can terminate if appropriation was not renewed and the tenant gives notice, we didn't get renewal of the appropriation. Therefore, I'm giving you notice, appropriation was not renewed, we therefore terminate. That would be consistent with Tabor and the rest of the article.
It would be consistent, Your Honor. I would put that interpretation under the category of a strained interpretation. You really need to reach another step or two to reach that, you know, to create that ambiguity. And the case law is clear that courts will not do that. Simply find an ambiguity. You can always find an ambiguity somewhere in the language because this is drafted by humans. But I would say that because you have to sort of take that extra step on saying, well, maybe it refers, even though non-renewal isn't used elsewhere in the contract, isn't defined, maybe it could refer to something else that might happen in the outside world. I don't believe that's sufficient to create an ambiguity.
I agree. Let me ask you the converse. I mean, and disagree with me if I'm misunderstanding, but I think you kind of are the assumption in your position here is that non-renewal refers to terminate. And I guess I'd ask, why is that necessarily true? If there's no right of renewal in the contract at all.
In this case, Your Honor, because again, the term is undefined elsewhere in the contract, I would go to simply the proximity of the term in the same sentence, reading together. The plain meaning of the sentence is you have this right to terminate. The way you do it is you give the landlord something called the notice of renewal, and you've got to do it by June 30th of each year.
The location of the paragraph that we're looking at right now is couched between the title Tabor Compliance and three paragraphs that subsequently follow it. Certainly, if this paragraph were a standalone paragraph and had its own title, a termination of lease or non-renewal of lease, it would be absolutely clear to me that there's no ambiguity here, that it says notwithstanding anything to the contrary, so forth, so on. But here it's couched in a section called Tabor Compliance, followed by three paragraphs dealing with Tabor Compliance. What are we to do with those other three paragraphs? Do they become mere a surplus at that point?
Not at all, Judge Ramon. And your argument is similar to an argument that was pressed in the appellee's brief, that we are somehow ripping this one sentence or this one paragraph out of its context in order to argue that it's unambiguous. That's simply not the case. What we have is a provision, Article 14, that is intended to make the contract comply with Tabor. The first thing it does under that heading is to provide for a termination right that complies with Tabor. Arguably, it is broader than is strictly necessary to comply with Tabor, but that is what the parties bargained for and agreed to.
But why do you need the second and third paragraph then, if that's the case?
Though you don't need them. They are recitals. They begin, the parties acknowledge, and they recite the reason for the Tabor compliance, Article 14, stating that, particularly in the context of the circumstances where Tabor law was still being litigated in this regard, that this contract is not intended to create an ongoing appropriation, that it is meant to comply with Tabor, and the parties acknowledge this. And then the fourth and final paragraph in Article 14 provides for a right for the school to become essentially a private school and to continue in the lease if its public funding is cut. Now, there is nothing in that provision and nothing in the contract that could direct the reader to read the converse right into that final paragraph, that because it can stay in the lease if its funding is cut, that necessarily means, as a matter of law, that unless its funding is cut, it must stay in the lease. So read together, there's nothing that conflict, and those paragraphs do not conflict with each other. The right in the first paragraph does what it says it will do, comply with Tabor.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Klingsborn. Let's take for argument's sake that we disagree that paragraphs 2 and 3 are recitals. And I think it's a difficult argument that you're making because, as you know, the normal recitals are at the beginning and they say whereas this and whereas that. I'm frankly having some difficulty. If they're not recitals, aren't they mere surplusage based on your argument?
This is the language that arguably was required by the school's contract with its sponsor. The sponsor didn't require any specific language, and we do not make the argument here, nor did we below, that any particular language in Article 14 was required by the sponsor. But the sponsor did require that the contract comply with Tabor and make clear that it complied with Tabor. So these recitals, regardless of whether the first paragraph is there, would comply with that requirement of the school's contract with its sponsor.
Is McKissick the best case for you on this point? I think that's, it seemed, I can't remember if you decided it or Mr. Forbes did.
We did, Your Honor, and it is the best case for this basic principle that simply because the parties mean to comply with a particular statute, that the rights that they grant to each other in the contract are meant to be restricted to only what is necessary to comply with that statute.
Right. Now, in McKissick, I'll float this to you, that it's, I'll say it's potentially distinguishable, because McKissick, as I recall the facts, it was a release, it was a very broad release, and the plaintiff wanted to say the release didn't include, it was limited to employment stuff, because look, later in the lease, it referred to employment. And the 10th Circuit said, and Judge Gorsuch, I think, wrote it, said, well, no, it's an including but not limited clause. Broad release, including but not limited these claims, to these claims. The problem here is there's nothing in paragraphs 2 and 3 or anything that says that they're illustrative only. As I understood your argument, you're kind of suggesting to us that the Tabor stuff was all illustrative of the broad principle that we can terminate. And McKissick sort of says, you don't get to read in, bootstrap the one into the other. It seems to me McKissick is distinguishable because it says including but not limited to.
Well, clearly the facts are somewhat different in McKissick, but I would disagree that you can distinguish it on that basis. What I think you've done, Judge Gabriel, is conflate two parts of the McKissick opinion by Judge Gorsuch. One of plaintiff's arguments was defeated by the including but not limited to language of the contract, but her argument that the that because the contract mentioned and recited the requirements of age discrimination statutes could not be read to create an ambiguity or to mean that the release itself, the unambiguously broad release, could be restricted to age discrimination statutes. And if there are no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve my last 3 minutes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Klingsborn. Mr. Forbes?
Thank you, Judge Gabriel. May it please the court. The Colorado Supreme Court.
Counsel, can I ask you just to introduce yourself for the record?
After you said my name, I thought.
I know you.
Yeah, Peter Forbes, here on behalf of the defendant, Appellee Eagle Heights Properties, LLC. Your Honor, as you know this probably better than we do, but I'll just recite a bit of what I think the controlling legal framework is. I start in 1990 because we're talking about modern approach to contract interpretation with the Total Petroleum case, 787 P. Second 164, Colorado Supreme Court case, where the court said one does not interpret contracts in a vacuum. One looks at the subject of the contract, one looks at the object, et cetera, et cetera. We then move a little forward to Lazy Dog, 965 P. Second 1129, where the court, it was obviously an easement case, but the court said when an easement is a form of contract, what we try to do is determine the intent of the parties, and we're not going to be applying a strict four corners approach anymore. We want to look at the circumstances, we want to look at the subject matter, and in addition, we want to look at surrounding extrinsic evidence, at least conditionally, to see if there is some type of ambiguity when we look at all the facts and the circumstances. Then, in the Eagle Ridge case, the Colorado Supreme Court, that's 109 P. 3rd 969, the Supreme Court emphasized again, we're not looking at a rigid four corners approach. In looking at some other cases and getting ready for the argument, one sees the importance of that in similar cases where one party says, oh, well, this is an absolute clause, it's unambiguous, just look at this one clause, it's unambiguous. An interesting case is E-470 versus Jagow, J-A-O-W, which is a one of the divisions of this court. It was 30 P. 3rd 798, affirmed by the Colorado Supreme Court, 49 P. 3rd 1151. That involved an annexation agreement. And the annexation agreement, the annexee, agreed that I will cede to the municipality any rights of way necessary for any highways, roads, et cetera, et cetera. And the E-470 came in and said, well, we don't have to condemn and pay for this property because it says highways. And if there's one thing E-470 is, it's a highway. And what the court did there is it said, no, we need to look at the surrounding circumstances. There was an ordinance that was enacted approving the annexation agreement, even though it wasn't part of the annexation agreement. They looked at that. Again, doing that, they found that highways didn't mean all highways. And in fact, in that case, they said it unambiguously doesn't mean all highways.
So I'm going to ask you a question. You apparently are leading toward, let's look at the surrounding circumstances in order to interpret this document. Are you saying that you need to look at external circumstances in order to find this ambiguous? In other words, you cannot determine that it's ambiguous simply by looking at the language itself.
No, I think in this case, with this term, there is an ambiguity on the face of the agreement itself.
Why don't we start there?
Okay. So here is why I think there's an ambiguity on the face of the agreement itself. We've got a provision entitled Tabor Compliance. That directs us that the object and purpose of this is to do a specific thing, which is to comply with Tabor. Then we've got the first paragraph that is the notwithstanding anything in the lease, there should be a right to terminate based on giving notice of non-renewal. An undefined term, notice of non-renewal. And in addition, as Mr. Klingsborn says, theoretically you could have a absolute termination right, or you could have a limited termination right. And nothing in that clause indicates which of the provisions the parties intended. Then we've got the second paragraph, which speaks in terms of the fact that CSI is not obligating itself to fund Magone in subsequent years to comply with Tabor. Then we've got paragraph 3, which refers to the fact that Magone is not obligating itself to fund in subsequent years in order to comply with Tabor. Then we've got paragraph 4, which speaks about termination for non-appropriation. And if they terminate for non-appropriation, they can nonetheless elect to go forward with private funds. Another non-defined term, is non-appropriation the same as, is notice of non-appropriation the same as notice of non-renewal, the same as a right to terminate? Then we ask ourselves, why, if we had an absolute right to terminate in the first place, would we ever have that fourth clause that talks about termination in the event of non-appropriation? Because if it was the intent of the parties was to give an absolute right of termination, you would never have a circumstance in which they would terminate for non-appropriation but continue to go forward. On the other hand, if the clause was intended to say that we need to have the right to terminate in the event of non-appropriation, we then could have a scenario where we're forced to terminate in order to comply with Tabor, but we nonetheless want to continue to use your facility.
Why couldn't that just simply be a separate ground for termination?
It could be. It could be. Indeed, it could be. The question is whether, on the face of this clause, that is the only plausible interpretation when you take the clause in its entirety. That's the question. And what I'm suggesting is because there are multiple reasonable ways to interpret these terms, particularly because they're not defined in the agreement, on its face you end up with an ambiguous clause. And Judge, I go even further because remember another key aspect of ambiguity, without getting into extrinsic evidence, is you look at all the provisions of the agreement. Okay, so what you need to do is go back and look at what the object and subject of this entire transaction is. It's a 10-year lease. It's a 10-year lease with options to buy. It's a 10-year lease committing the landlord to make significant tenant improvements. It's a 10-year lease that was modified to provide provisions for remediation of asbestos that would be recovered in the event the option to purchase was exercised. So when we look at the entire agreement, we say, is it the only reasonable interpretation that this 10-year lease where the landlord agreed to invest significant monies was to be terminable at the whim of the tenant.
But counsel, what effect does the notwithstanding language have on the rest of the agreement or the entire agreement? When it says notwithstanding anything to the contrary in this lease, a tenant may elect to terminate this lease at the end of any current fiscal year.
Two comments on that. Number one, they said in the reply brief that they're not really relying on the notwithstanding language. I think they said something to the effect of, we don't need that to get where we are. But setting that aside.
They're reviewing de novo. I would appreciate it.
Right. No, understood. Setting that aside, here's what I think. There are a couple of cases that actually, to my mind, push us to look at what the parties intended when they used that language. One of them is one of the leading interpretive cases, the KN Energy case. KN Energy versus Great Western Sugar. And I've got the site float around here someplace. Oh, here it is. It's 698 P. Second 769. The reason I think that case is interesting on this point is because the clause in that case said that the gas supplier, KN Energy, would have the absolute discretion, those are the exact words in the contract, would have absolute discretion to determine whether to interrupt service based on the needs of its higher priority customers. And it said, basically, look, if we have absolute discretion, we have absolute discretion. I think that's a very similar clause to a notwithstanding anything else. And what the court said in that case was, just even though that particular clause says notwithstanding anything, I'm sorry, it said you have the absolute discretion, you looked at the entire rest of the agreement, and the court determined that when you looked at the rest of the agreement, you could see that the intent and purpose of this was not to grant an absolute discretion. Then they looked at the course of dealing between the parties and said, well, the parties previously had a course of dealing where that clause had taken on a certain patina, a certain meaning between the parties. And they looked at various factors unique to that transaction to find out that there was no absolute discretion, even though it appeared to be absolute discretion. Here, I think what you have to do and what we do with that language is, as the trial court said, we can't just take that one sentence and say that trumps everything else, because that's not what Colorado law says. It says Tabor compliance, the title. Well, is notwithstanding, was that put in to make clear, absolutely clear, that you could terminate in the event of a non-appropriation? The notwithstanding then refers to the right to terminate by notice of non-renewal. Well, what does that mean? What did the parties intend by that language? Is there, as you look through the whole clause, do they intend to give an absolute right, or do they only intend to ensure compliance with Tabor, as the title says? So I think what that does is says we have to look at that term in context, just like we have to look at any other term in a contract in context.
Doesn't it, you know, folks, I mean, I really want to get a reaction out of you. I mean, another reading of that notwithstanding any of the contrary in this lease is it's comparing itself to the other provisions elsewhere, other articles of the lease. And I ask that because I couldn't help but notice the distinction in that language and the language at the beginning of paragraph 4, which says, notwithstanding anything set forth above. And so, I mean, one argument, and like you react to it, and giving Mr. Klingsporn a heads up too, he could react as well. I mean, you could say that first, this notwithstanding anything to the contrary in the lease, really was to distinguish Article 14 from any other rights of termination or rights not to terminate, which is different than the paragraph 4 beginning, which would say that really is talking about just Article 14.
Well, I think I agree with your point.
I didn't get it out very well, so I'm glad.
I think that what we have to do is, and this is what we do now with contracts, is we step back and we say, and this is, it goes back at least as far as the decision of the court in, my mind goes total petroleum, is you can't just do it in isolation. And what we're trying to do here is do a 10-year lease with a provision that will ensure compliance with Tabor, but will still allow the parties to enter into a 10-year lease. So I think the notwithstanding is so that the landlord couldn't say, oh, well, you haven't been appropriated, well, look at this clause. You still can't terminate, or you still can't non-renew, or whatever you call it. You still can't get out of the lease because of this clause, or you still can't get out of the lease because of that clause. That seems to me, when you look at what we've got here, to be the reasonable meaning, or a reasonable meaning of that clause. Because remember, if there are multiple reasonable meanings of that clause, then we look at the extrinsic evidence, not for purposes of the finding an ambiguity, but for purposes of finding the party's intent. And we have to remember that the court found that the parties did not intend to create an absolute termination right, that the party's intent was to create a right that would only allow termination to the extent necessary to ensure compliance with Tabor.
But in doing so, the court relied on a lot of extrinsic evidence, correct?
He did, and I think this is actually, and conceptually, I haven't really been able to formulate this point, so I'll put it out here now and see where it goes, if any place. It's kind of interesting because when you look at Lazy Dog and when you look at Eastridge, the court almost says you make the same inquiry in determining whether a lease is ambiguous that you do in determining the meaning of an ambiguous lease. Because it says you look at all the extrinsic factors surrounding the negotiation. You look at all those factors, and if all those factors lead you to conclude that the parties could have intended A or B, why then you'd say, okay, now I start my analysis of what the parties really intended with all the extrinsic evidence I used to find if there's ambiguity in the first place.
But isn't there a limit on that? I mean, for example, Public Service Company versus Meadow Island Ditch. As I read that, it says you can consider extrinsic evidence to decide if a provision is ambiguous, but you can't consider extrinsic evidence of intent. So, for example, you can consider if this word is a term of art in this industry, you can consider that. I mean, I'll tell you, I have a little bit of concern with what the court did, because it seemed to let in a lot of evidence, extrinsic evidence of intent, as opposed to specific usage in the industry and the like.
Well, as I see it, what we're really talking about with an extrinsic evidence of intent, if you go back to Kane Energy, when that phrase, where that comes from, what we're really talking about is we can't let the parties say, well, this is how I understood it, or this is how I understood it, or this is how I understood it. But if you make a proposal from one party to the other, that can be relevant. And in fact, I've just did this case in California where that is what they say. They say, you know, subjective expressions of intent can't be used, but everything else is fair game.
Thank you, Mr. Forbes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's 2 minutes and 48 seconds.
About 3 minutes, so I'll try to make 3 points. and I'll begin with that last question of yours, Judge Gabriel. I agree that the court below let in a tremendous amount of extrinsic evidence about intent, and also I agree with my colleague that the judge below, Judge Delgado, conflated these two inquiries. As I read the case law, extrinsic evidence comes in before this threshold determination of ambiguity, and in order to help the court make this threshold determination of ambiguity, only when the court needs help to define the meaning of the written terms. One instance is this specific industry jargon example. Another is when it's an ancient document. Another is when there's a local usage. These are the narrow exceptions where a court can say, I know it says something clearly and plainly on the face of it, but I'm being told that the plain, ordinary meaning of those terms doesn't apply here, that there's something special. And so I'll open the door a little bit and let you tell me how you use these in the industry, or how you use this in this county and historically, or how people in the 19th century used this term. None of those are the case here. And so that doesn't help Eagle Heights rescue Judge Delgado's opinion or make the admission of all this other extrinsic evidence any more correct. Secondly, we started to hear a bit about the nature of the transaction, the subject matter of the transaction, the surrounding circumstances, and how that there's language in the case law that allows the court to consider this. First point on that is that most of that case law surrounds interpreting the contract once you have found it ambiguous. This is the loophole through which Eagle Heights tries to pull in all of the extrinsic evidence about intent, about the economic structure of the lease, and about the landlord's economic expectations. But to apply the exception this broadly, as I believe the questions are already pointing, is to get rid of the parole evidence rule. If the nature of the transaction means everything, intent, economic structure, Tabor, everything else, and if the exception is applied this broadly, that would be to gut the parole evidence rule. There'd be nothing left. All the evidence would come in before the term is determined to be ambiguous. Contracts would lose certainty, and courts would be in the business of assessing whether or not contracts make economic sense and whether or not the parties could really have meant what they put down on paper. And that cannot be the law. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Greenspan. Let me thank both counsel for your briefs and the excellent oral arguments that we heard today. Also, just personally want to thank you both for the professionalism and civility that I saw here today. As you all know, lawyers get dinged plenty, and we hear plenty about lack of civility, and it's nice and refreshing to see the way it's supposed to work. So thank you both for that. The court very much appreciates it. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both.